listening to The Green Majority. Your host, Aaron Kasters, here. GreenMajority.ca. We're produced live every Friday on CIUT 89.5 in Toronto. I am joined today for the majority of the show. Nice to see you actually in the studio, Kevin Farmer. Thanks for joining me. We've got a couple other people here. We're going to be doing a little bit of structural experimenting today. We've got a little bit of a different format. We're going to be playing around with some of the stuff. So this is a great opportunity, if you're happening to be listening to the episode today, to go ahead and send us an email, send them some comments about and feedback about the type of the format, some of the things, some of the topic choices, some of the style choices, whatever you happen to feel about the show, or if you just want to send us an email and say, you're doing a great job, guys, keep it up. You know, we don't turn away any email at all. Go ahead, send us an email at thegreenmajority@gmail.com. However, we're going to get the show started today. We've got a couple of features coming up today. We've got Danny Harvey, who's an associate professor in the Department of Geography with the University of Toronto, whose expertise is in atmospheric ocean interaction, transient climate response, and efficiency and renewables. He's going to be talking to us in the first half about climate change science, what the most recent data is, what the effect on the general public is, and the relevance of climate change science to the Superstorm Sandy that we've all been recently hearing about, not to mention the absence of that connection made in the mainstream media on a regular basis. Second half, we've got Liam O'Doherty, of course, friend of the show. He's been on lots of times with Taking It Global. Liam was up at PowerShift 2012. We had an episode a few weeks ago where we talked to some folks with the Canadian Youth Climate Coalition talking about PowerShift. It was a great interview. If you missed it, go back and check the website. But we're now going to be talking to Liam in the second half about the event. The whole thing's been done. It seemed like it was a great success. I saw lots of Twitter feed posts coming back, lots of Facebook updates, lots of pictures. Very, very jealous I was not able to make it. But Liam's gonna live us through that experience for you. And hopefully we'll all be able, myself included, to join them next year if you weren't able to go to PowerShift 2012. However, without further ado, we're going to start the program off with sort of an amended feature section. We're just going to kind of run through some headlines here. All the features, all the stories that we talk about today will be available on the website if you want to go and actually read the actual stories here. But we're just going to give you a little kind of top stories in brief. These will be today. Kevin, we're going to be starting with a story out of Vancouver. We're talking about BC ocean fertilization experiment and how it's going to, quote, make waves at a UN meeting this week. What exactly is this story talking about?
Well, basically, it's discussing the viability of geoengineering, which is an extremely controversial practice whereby large projects have been conceived to try to manipulate the environment to offset climate change, and these projects are really large scale and really quite fantastic in their conception. You know, there's been talk of deploying mirrors in space to deflect the sun's light, and in particular, this article mentions the dumping of I forget how much, but tons and tons of iron into the ocean to fertilize it.
That sounds like a great idea.
Yeah,
just dump a bunch of stuff in the ocean.
Yeah, exactly. It's a poorly the hope is that it'll cause algae blooms which will absorb carbon, and when they die they will sequester that carbon on the bottom of the ocean. It's a poorly understood side effect of climate change that the excess of carbon in the atmosphere right now is leading to the formation of carbonic acid in the oceans, and the oceans are slowly acidifying, which is a death knell for any creature that relies on having a shell, which is usually made out of calcium. And when we're talking about, so we're talking about plankton, which are the base of, you know, the long marine food chains. And we're talking about we're already messing with the largest ecosystem on Earth with climate change. And now we want to engage in uncontrolled experiments to further alter the ocean's chemistry rather than simply dealing with the emissions side of the equation. We're conceiving of these huge, massively scaled projects, uncontrolled experiments to try to offset climate change. And it shows that we've reached a crisis. We're reaching a new crisis in climate change now, where we're still still we're pumping, you know, gigatons of carbon into the atmosphere, but now we're also going to engage in other uncontrolled experiments with the Earth's biosphere and see, and just, you know, sort of hope that it turns out very well.
Yeah, and I think that's the main point that people should be paying attention to is, I mean, even if there have been small scale sort of experiments, doing something on any scale that would affect global climate is in and of itself an experiment. It doesn't matter if you've done it on a small scale before, because part of the reason why we got ourselves into climate change in the first place is that we're talking about systems we don't understand that we can't predict.
Exactly.
You know, that's the difference between meteorology and climatology. Meteorology is guessing the weather a few days in advance. I mean, that's a super oversimplification. I'm sure there's meteorologists somewhere listening, pulling their head up. But for in a layman's sense, meteorology is predicting the weather, you know, up to the next week. Will it be sunny next Thursday? Of which they can only, you know, they can't even say that with any certainty. Climatology is talking about complex climate systems. We have no freaking idea what we're doing. That's how we got into this mess in the first place.
And what
and
I wonder,
we want to mess with that by dumping a bunch of stuff into it. It's absolute insanity.
Exactly. Opinion. And what page of human history are they reading that shows that we have any ability to manipulate ecosystems without destroying them? I'm unaware of any case where humanity has manipulated an ecosystem without radically altering it and ultimately derailing it. Just look at the history of invasive species in Australia, where, you know, rabbits have become a plague, and then they you know.
I was just going to give the same example. Yeah, it sounds very much like a Simpsons episode, actually.
Yeah, and then they bring in a new invasive species to control the old invasive species, but it doesn't behave the way they expected, and it also becomes a plague, and then the next invasive species to control that one also becomes a plague.
Well, I'm just waiting for, you know, they dump a bunch of iron file. It was iron, right?
Dust.
They dump a bunch of iron dust into the ocean, and oh shoot, we screwed up something else, and then the next thing they're proposing is sharks with freaking laser beams on their head or something. Like, who knows what's going to happen? Anyway, we'll have to leave it there. If you're interested in reading that story, that will be posted on the show page a little bit later today, which is Friday. You can go ahead and read that article. If you have any comments, concerns, or anything about any of our commentary or about the story itself, you can go ahead and throw that on the Facebook page, send us an email, anything you like. However, we're going to take a little bit of another turn now. Very relevant topic. We're going to be speaking to Danny Harvey, Associate Professor, Department of Geography at the University of Toronto, is our first guest of the show. Welcome to the Green Majority, Danny Harvey.
Welcome, Darren.
So we asked you to come on today a little bit. You've heard a little bit of talk about this in the alternative media, virtually none in the mainstream media. We wanted to get your sort of some facts straight about what we can and can't say about the relevance of Hurricane Sandy that we just sort of finished experiencing here and climate change. What can we make a connection between, and what can't we make a connection?
Well, what we can say is the Atlantic Ocean off the U.S. East Coast is at record warmth. It's about 3 degrees Celsius above normal. Now, most of that 3 degrees would be natural variability, because the magnitude of natural variability is quite large. But maybe 20% of that is due to the overall background warming. So you could say maybe 20% of that warming is part of the long-term global warming trend, and so contributed to the strength of Hurricane Sandy. I mean, when you have a warmer ocean, you're going to have more water vapor. The water vapor, when it condenses, releases latent heat. That's part of what powers the tropical storm. And, of course, it brings lots of rain. Another connection that I think is a little more speculative is the record loss of Arctic sea ice. I mean, this September, the extent of sea ice in the Arctic was 50% of what it had been 20 or 30 years ago. And that's going to cause a sort of a distortion in the jet stream pattern, which a couple of meteorologists at least think, you know, is bringing the winds in the way that created this unusual combination of sort of a normal sort of mid-latitude winter storm and a tropical storm. The other thing to keep in mind, though, is that there are, you know, if you look at the, you know, records of evidence of flooding and rainfall events in lake sediments, I mean, there is evidence that there have been long cycles and long trends and you know, big superstorms in the past. So I guess the answer is, you know, nature, the climate system is complicated. Many things are happening. There's natural variability. There's long-term trends. But behind it all, we are warming the climate, and warming the climate is expected to make the kinds of things like we saw on the weekend more frequent and possibly more severe. So yeah, it could very well global warming could very well have been a contributing factor. And certainly Michael Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, has emphasized, I was reading in the newspaper this morning, the possibility that, you know, this is connected to, in some way, not entirely, to changes in climate.
Did you, I'm not sure if you caught the story that we were referencing there just before we got you on the air, but I'm sure you've heard of it. I was in one of your climate science classes, and I know we talked about it a little bit in that class, but the idea that the news story that they're talking about today about BC ocean fertilization experiments with iron, do you have any comments on that? Kevin and I were just talking about how silly we thought that sort of thing was. Are we wrong? Do you think that sort of mitigation, is a good idea?
I think it's early to do that. The first thing we should be doing is seriously reducing emissions, and we're not doing that, and it's like completely off the radar here in Canada, the political radar and the public radar. We're doing, you know, essentially nothing. The second thing is, you know, the papers that I've read have indicated it's not going to work in the long run. I mean, okay, so you pull some carbon out of the surface waters by enhancing marine photosynthesis, but then the organisms settle down into deeper water and decay and release CO2 back into the intermediate depth waters, which then eventually upwells or diffuses back to the surface. So I don't think there's any evidence that it really has a significant long-term effect in the first place. I mean, you know, if you look at just the direct immediate effects, you might think it's having a benefit and you might claim some credit. But I think when you look at the larger scale system, I don't think there's evidence. I haven't seen any evidence that it really is going to make a big difference.
You say you said it's a little bit early to be doing these types of experiments. With the sort of unpredictability of the effects of these, when would be the time that we should be thinking about these? I mean, they're highly dangerous in the sense that we don't, even if we have a fairly good idea what we think will happen, this is definitely when we're talking about adjusting climate.
Yeah.
That's some pretty intense stuff. I mean, we're talking about, you know, terraforming almost if you're a sci-fi fan. You know, when is the time when we should be looking at these sort of extreme options?
Well, I think once fossil fuel emissions are down to zero, okay, which means then the CO2 concentration will begin to gradually fall on its own, over a period of hundreds of years. And if at that time we found out we've definitely overshot safe levels and they're not going to come back down on their own fast enough before provoking irreversible collapse of the Greenland ice sheet or something like that, then we might have to carry out some temporary geoengineering type intervention, of which iron fertilization or something like it might qualify as geoengineering. But there's no point doing it at all if emissions haven't been reduced, because, you know, the benefits, whatever there may be, of any kind of geoengineering are going to be swamped by the continuing emissions. So the first priority is bring emissions down to zero, get us off of fossil fuels, make the transition to a carbon-free renewable energy system, which will take decades, even going flat out, and then evaluate the situation at that time.
And so as far as the public media, I know something when we spoke to you, we've had you on the program before, and when we spoke before, we were talking a little bit about the sort of denialism, funded denialism by people with interests. We hear a lot in the news these days. You're starting to get news about groups like the Koch brothers, for instance, who have very, very rich individuals who have invested heavily in oil and gas, who are have now been able to establish links between them and a wide range of quote-unquote skepticism organizations and people putting out ads criticizing. Do you think that in your opinion, in your experience, either through your experience at the University of Toronto or just by reading the news or whatever, are the denialists losing the battle at this point, or are we still battling for public opinion on this issue?
I think we're still battling for public opinion. I mean, a large segment of the population, especially in the United States, still hasn't got their mind around the most basic fact, which is that the climate is warming. I mean, that is undeniable. The evidence is overwhelming. It's all around us. And yet, here, like the most basic, you know, step one in the chain of logic and understanding, step one, people still can't accept, and it's just beyond doubt that the climate is warming.
I think one of the easiest arguments that can be made to the folks on the other side of the fence, if you will, one that was outlined in that Bloomberg article that you referenced, and it was also talked about on if you're listening live on CIUT, you may have just caught Democracy Now, who is speaking to a gentleman who wrote the Bloomberg Business Week article talking about where it said it's climate change stupid was the headline that's been making the rounds all over social media. We posted it on our site as well.
Yeah.
One of the arguments there that they put in was, you know, if you're not convinced by the science, you should at least be convinced by market indicators. And what he was getting at there was that one of the things that they've started to spot a trend in was that insurance agencies, the insurance, depending on what you're looking to insure, has been skyrocketing because the insurance industry has been thoroughly convinced that this is a real effect and they need to adjust their business plan based on it. My question, which is a little bit of a silly question, I suppose, was what further evidence could we possibly need? I mean, if people who don't respect science or scientists, you would think that would be part of the crew that would be very, very interested in respecting the business community and market trends. Who left could deny after all this? I mean, you know, all the scientists and now, you know, many economists, or at least, you know, the economists who are working in industries directly for industries like the insurance industry that are doing risk evaluation seem pretty thoroughly convinced. I'm wondering sort of who's left to be unconvinced by both of those arguments.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it's really remarkable. I mean, I guess as a psychologist, it would be it's interesting to observe the extent to which people will, you know, twist themselves to deny what's right in front of them. But we have this amazing capacity to deny something that's right in front of us.
Well, I'm afraid I wouldn't have a better answer to that than that either, although I have actually seen some studies. We published or posted some stuff on our Facebook page recently, actually, about an article that was in Alternatives Journal talking about how people make decisions as well. So you can definitely check out our Facebook page or Alternatives Journal as well if you're interested in that topic. That's all the time we have for right now. Thank you very much for joining us again, Danny Harvey, Associate Professor in the Department of Geography with the University of Toronto. Thanks again.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Bye.
All right. So we're going to go to a quick music break now, and we'll come right back. We're going to do another little bit of a headline roundup with Kevin Farmer, and then we're going to move on to Liam O'Doherty, who's going to talk to us about PowerShift 2012. Stay tuned. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
It's mine all this time.
So to sing along, come
walk it over. I live among
the alarms
where I trip, where they sing.
So to sing along, come
hey, come over. Up the hill
goes the time,
right to the beat of my step.
So to sing along,
undiscovered. And all the years,
a quarter speed,
haloed out, trembling clean.
So to sing along,
turning over.
Thank you.
My name is Darren Kaster, host of The Green Majority, which is what you're listening to, greenmajority.ca. You're listening on CIUT 89.5. And or you may not be listening on CIUT 89.5 because we have at least 17 wonderful, fantastic, beautiful community radio partners coast to coast as well. We're also posting our content on greenmajority.ca, Facebook, Twitter. We have a delicious feed, soon to be giant billboards in the space. Right beside those mirrors. I think, Kevin, we were looking at maybe sponsoring one of those giant space mirrors that's going to deal with climate change. I don't know. this week that caught my attention was Natural Resources Minister Joe Oliver said he didn't know very much about energy projects. Secret emails reveal. What are your thoughts on that story?
Yeah, so access to information has revealed internal emails that showing Minister Joe Oliver doesn't feel up to speed, basically, on the projects under his portfolio, and that he disagrees profoundly with the former Environment Minister Jim Prentice. There's a quote in the article. One of my favorite quotes from Jim Prentice was where he commented in a speech that energy leadership and environmental leadership are two sides of the same coin, and this is true. But Joe Oliver, our current natural resources minister, who is a lawyer and an investment banker, has said he doesn't really agree with Prentice's former views, and he's actually, the article points out that Joe Oliver, our natural resources minister, has described environmentalists as extremists and radicals who want to kill Canadian jobs. And
I don't know about you. I've personally feel like I've killed at least 5 jobs in the past 5 years. We need to get more efficient. But
well, this is just another indication of the disdain that the corrupt Petro regime of the Harper government holds for the environment and natural resources. You know, I have to make a small anecdote here. I campaigned as the Green Party candidate in the riding of St. Paul's in Toronto in the 2006 federal election, and one of the person campaigning for the Tories was Peter Kent, who is now our environment minister, and I got to know, you know, we spent a lot of time together. We were at a lot of debates and Q&As, and you just sort of spend a lot of time with your opponents and you get to know them fairly well. And anyway, Peter Kent had a great line. I thought that part of his stump speech was that he liked to say that he wanted to be St. Paul's representative in Ottawa and not Ottawa's apologist in St. Paul's. And I thought it was a great line. And I thought, wow, what a wonderful way of saying it. And if it's true, you know, good on you. And now he's apologist in chief, which is the only way you can describe an environment posting under the Harper government. And so to the natural resources post, we get a banker, investment banker, and a lawyer, who with degrees, you know, who's admitting that he doesn't understand energy projects under his portfolio. And it just goes to show again the low priority that harmonizing policy within environmental imperatives takes in the Harper government.
Yeah, I think something that's relevant has been making the rounds a little bit is there were some stories out of the U.S. During the political cycle now that several members of the Science Council, I'm not sure what the actual term for it is, but the Science Board, the group in the government in the U.S. that decides sort of what projects get money, how much money should we give to NASA, that sort of thing, are all really, really fundamentalist Christians. And you know, this isn't a religion show. We're not going to talk about religion on the show. But, you know, we're talking about people who think, you know, climate change might be real, but we shouldn't do anything about it because, you know, God will sort it out. And that, like, if we're talking about that level, then I have no problem whatsoever calling that person an idiot. I mean, because clearly, you know, you take your own garbage out. If your house was on fire, you'd call the fire department. You clearly think that your agency is important.
Right.
But when we talk about, you know, large macro scale issues, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
It's insanity. So anyway, that's all. If you're interested in that story, we'll be posting that. That story was actually was by Mike D'Souza. He's been on the program before. Great author. You should check out his work. All the stories we discussed today will be on the website. Go ahead. If you have any comments, as I said before, you can send us our Facebook page. send us an email at thegreenmajority@gmail.com. If you manage to find my phone number somewhere, you can send me a text message, but I'm not going to hand it out. Anything you like, any way you can contact us, go ahead and do so. We love to hear feedback from our listeners, whether you think something about the story or about the format. As I said, we're doing a little bit of formatting experiments these days. Over the next few shows, we're going to be trying some stuff out. So please do give us your feedback. We're going to go now to Liam O'Doherty, who I have on the line with Taking It Global. Liam, you just got back from PowerShift. How do you feel?
I feel great. I feel really energized and inspired by all of the different young people around the country who are actively kind of engaging with the environmental issue and who showed a lot of energy and passion for working towards real solutions last weekend.
Fantastic. Yeah, and I was very jealously looking at some of the photos that were there. Unfortunately, my actual paid job required that I was not able to attend this year. But I have gone in the past. It was really great. Can you talk to us a little bit? We had an interview with Canadian Youth Climate Coalition prior to the event. Now, having been, can you tell us a little bit about the way that the event was structured? Give us a reminder about what exactly was going on and what sort of events people could have attended if they'd been there.
Absolutely. So there were 4 days of kind of trainings and workshops, and we did a march and keynote speakers. There was a really successful dual plenary session that featured speakers such as Bill McKibben and Naomi Klein. We heard from a lot of Aboriginal voices about the kind of the effects that our current energy infrastructure is having on their lives and their livelihoods and their families. And then there was a really fun march where we basically visited the Prime Minister's office to do a die-in, and we visited the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers to demand that the government stop giving massive corporate handouts to the most polluting and profitable companies on the planet right now. Right now, oil companies get $1.14 billion from the government, and during a time of kind of economic recession where we're being told that we don't have enough budget to kind of pay for services and services are being slashed, we were pointing out that basically the very profitable companies don't deserve to be getting our tax dollars.
I think if I can just pause you there for a second, yep. That's something that we wanted to, we spoke yesterday, it sort of touched base about this, and it's something that I sort of wanted to do as a feature idea, and I guess I'm sort of saying it on air to make myself commit to actually doing it. But I would love, if any of our listeners can help with it, that would be absolutely superb. Again, you can email us at thegreenmajority@gmail.com. I want to get some politicians, and I'm not looking to get a conservative on, skewer them. I'm not looking to necessarily, you know, get a Green Party or an NDP or a Liberal or somebody else, anybody else from any party. We're not interested in playing party politics. I just want somebody who knows more than I to explain to me why oil companies get subsidies. Bottom line, it doesn't even have to be an environment. You can remove environment entirely from the conversation. I'm just talking about, you know, regardless of what my political leanings are, I'm fiscally conservative, let's say. I want to know that I'm not wasting money on big government and that I don't need to. I would like to know why we're giving money to the richest people in, you know, richest companies in the world. This is like if you went to work and every day you showed up at work, you gave your boss $10 and said, thanks for letting me work here. I really would like someone to explain it to me. So, Liam, I don't know if you have an answer to that question, but if anyone else wants to help us get a politician or an economist or somebody on the air who can explain to me why we give oil companies subsidies, I'm really terribly confused about that. And I think you can remove environment entirely from that conversation.
Yeah.
Sorry. I wasn't sure if we lost you, Liam. Go ahead.
No, still here. We were trying to figure out why that is and, you know, show our kind of anger and disappointment and basically demand that stop. Because that type of subsidies, those types of subsidies are kind of holding back the green economy that we're looking for and kind of green jobs and all of the different, the different other ways that money could be spent on things such as education or providing drinkable water across reserves across the country. There's so many other valuable things that money could be spent on today.
Absolutely. And I mean, even if you're just talking about the distribution of energy resources that we have in, anywhere, but in this case, obviously in Canada, we're talking about an industry that's already incredibly profitable. They don't need any incentive to do what they're doing because they are already, you know, if you take out the oil subsidies, it's like a speck on their drop sheet. I mean, they're still making billions and billions of dollars. So it's not like the oil companies need this incentive, otherwise they wouldn't be producing oil. That's, complete nonsense. So, If you took that, I mean, if you talk about the amount of money in the market, if you took those oil subsidies and even just removed them to level the playing field a little bit, much less redistributed those to alternative energy, I mean, the effects would be massive. We've had Tim Nash on the program a number of times to talk about the massive expansions in alternative energy, both in Canada and internationally. And this is all despite having a massive field disadvantage against them. I mean, it's absolutely incredible.
Absolutely. It was really interesting to see, too, kind of at the end of PowerShift, how Sandy and the massive storm and the kind of effects that climate change is having today kind of hit the news and broke. And so as we were kind of going back home from PowerShift, the effects of that climate change is having today was becoming so much apparent and kind of broke on the news. And so in some ways, PowerShift happened at a very kind of historic time. And it was really exciting to see all the kind of passion and energy in young people today.
Mm-hmm. So, looking forward, what do you feel like some of the takeaway messages was? I know a lot of a big portion of what happens at PowerShift is they're workshops, but they're very interactive workshops. And I know you didn't know enough to know that you went to as many as you possibly could. So, what are some of the feelings? What were some of the reactions and sort of the tone with which people young people from all over Canada came to this? Was it generally you were saying you felt very positive? Was it, the outcome was everything? Was everyone was feeling very excited, or was there sort of dismay at all the work that we have to go ahead of us? What sort of energy left PowerShift, and what sort of ideas came out of it that you heard about?
Well, there are obviously a lot of kind of high emotions when you get 1,000 young people into the same kind of organizing space and have them really realize and how all of the different struggles that we're facing are connected in many different ways. And to have the kind of emotional connection with people whose ways of life are being threatened and whose families are getting sick, and to actually physically connect with those people and understand how our way of life is affecting them. That kind of visceral emotional connection is sometimes very powerful and has, sometimes a very inspiring effect on us. It was really kind of overwhelming at points because, the scope of what we are trying to achieve here is massive in terms of, switching how our society runs and how our energy system runs. But at the same time, one of the main messages was what happens at PowerShift doesn't stay at PowerShift. And so it was a really kind of interesting crystallizing moment where kind of establishing and figuring out a network of different activist groups who are going to kind of continue to mobilize back in their own communities to oppose various pipeline expansions and kind of continue to organize and support each other as groups within their own local communities. And I was excited to see that.
Yeah, actually, on that kind of topic there, the third story, national story that we'd sort of picked out to discuss a little bit today was the TransCanada deal where the Chinese owned Phoenix Energy Partner was kind of joining in. So there's been a lot of noise on Facebook and Twitter and stuff like that, specifically with groups like Occupy Canada, a Facebook page and stuff like that, talking about how even outside of the environmental standpoint, is that even from a our resources sort of sense, this is their people are upset because it's sort of selling out our resources wholesale rather than taking advantage of them. We're simply tearing them off and giving them away bit by bit. With that as an example, and maybe Kevin wants to jump in here with a little bit if he has anything to say about that kind of third story we had picked out for today. But with specific projects like that, you were talking about people keeping the energy going after PowerShift. Was there any sort of sense of groups sort of teaming up to work together after PowerShift and continue working on specific issues? Was there sort of any like action groups that were sort of made out of this, or was this more kind of network establishment and just sort of generalized keeping in contact with each other?
A bit of both. There's definitely kind of struggles that are already happening, such as the Defend Our Coast campaign and standing with ACFN, the Athabasca Chippewa First Nations group. But there's already kind of these PowerShift Montreal and PowerShift Toronto and these local organizing hubs that were basically coming together to help ensure that their communities were represented at PowerShift, like to help organize the bus infrastructure, for example. And so kind of these groups have already been seeded, and so they're going to continue to kind of organize both kind of communally and with kind of an organizing thread that goes through them and allows the transmission of kind of more national-type struggles to be communicated. But there's a whole kind of series and network of groups who are working together on these issues, and PowerShift was definitely a time for them to connect and share ideas and start to plan and strategize for what's coming next.
Mm-hmm. And with a little bit more detail, we'll go back to Kevin for a second here. The third story, as I mentioned, picked out was talking about the Chinese-owned Phoenix Energy buying into some of the oil sands pipelines and really sort of multinationalizing some of the resources here. And I think the key point to take out from the story was, of course, the idea that by giving away the rights, we're also giving away the control to stop it. As well, I think, is one of the takeaway stories. But Kevin, what were your thoughts on that article?
Well, to pick up on the point you just made, we're currently negotiating a treaty with China, which is on the scale of NAFTA, and it would you know sort of provide some of the same privileges under NAFTA whereby business interests could. Dictate policy that they feel discriminates against their business interests in Canada. So in particular, they could challenge environmental policies in Canadian courts that they feel hampers their ability to conduct free trade in Canada regarding resources. Harper is on record. He has said many times that he plans on turning Canada into an energy superpower. And he is clearly taking this country away from a manufacturing footing and away from a knowledge-based economy into the extractive resources economy, which is why our dollar is so high now, and why jobs are disappearing in Quebec and Ontario. But what gets overlooked a little bit here is kind of another warning sign to planet Earth. The planet already can't withstand the impacts of the richest, say, billion people on Earth. The OECD nations, the high consumers like Canada and the U.S., where we disproportionately consume energy and material goods, and which is the lifestyle that we consider to be our birthright. The planet is already breaking under the strain of those impacts, and we're about to industrialize all of China and all of India at absolutely blinding speeds. This is going to appear, the industrialization of China will look as if it happened overnight by the time it's finished. What we're doing is we're exporting that model of the Western model, the OECD model of the consumptive lifestyle to 2-3 billion more people. And there's just I ran a computer simulation on the pollution that was going to get generated by this, and we're causing literally a tidal wave of pollution, As I already commented, the Earth already can't sustain the major predators, which are the developed nations, mm-hmm. and we're going to now include China and India in that consumptive lifestyle.
Yeah, some of my classes that we're dealing actually with some of my urban studies classes would show pictures not having nothing to do with the environment at all, but of course that's the lens the which I viewed it. But they showed a series of pictures of developments in China, and they asked you to guess what the time span between the photos was, and we're talking about at one end it was a photo of I'm going to have to ballpark it here, but somewhere between 3 to 5 million people in a region. The middle one was 25 million, and the top one was 100 million. And they asked us to guess what we thought the time period between those three was. And I was, it was like 50 years. Was this maybe the first one was in 1960, second one's in 1970, and then the third one was 1990 or something like that. No, the entire thing was over the span of like 15 years.
Right.
It went from like 5 million to 100 million over like 14, 15 years. And so by blinding speed, just to give it sort of a number to go along with what you mean by blinding. Blinding is really the best word for it, I think. We're going to take another quick break. Liam, hopefully we can get you to stick around for a minute. We're going to take a quick music break, and then we want to come back about just talk and kind of sum all this stuff up and talk about environmental coverage in the media. And it's great for us because it means more people will listen to our show. But in a total sense, the absolute travesty of how little specifically climate change, but environmental issues in general get in the mainstream media and why maybe that is. There's an article that we're going to reference coming back to that. So hopefully Liam and all of you will stick around. We'll be right back after this music break. Thank you.
Get your act together, please. Help your baba to get the leaves. Oh, go and help your grandfather. He's 77 and you're 11. So break the yard or clean the eavesdrop. One or the other. The baba, baba, please. Please. Oh, oh,
and we are back with the Green Majority. We've got one more segment to go here in the program. Kevin, I grabbed an article off our news feed this week. Not really a headline. It was an op-ed piece, I guess. But just somebody basically having a mental breakdown. a reporter having a bit of a spaz out a little bit. I think very appropriate, however. I don't want to make it sound like he was being ridiculous. But just complaining about the absolute insanity level to which the mainstream media ignores environmental issues and specifically climate change. You had an opportunity, had the look at the article. What did you think?
Oh, it's a great article. I hope, and I noticed you posted it on the Green Majority website, which is great. Everyone should read this article. It's extremely well written, and it could not possibly be more relevant or to the point. It's true. I mean, what can you say? Journalists are guilty of not educating themselves on the topic. They're too quick to release talking points and spin as news segments. And as you know, as we've already referenced in the show, the carbon lobby funds studies of their own, which are skewed in their favor. They pay so-called authorities to be professional skeptics, And journalism still is guilty of this, sense of false balance where for every point you have to bring up a counterpoint. But I mean, you could bring the same level of insanity to spousal abuse and find someone who thinks it's a great idea. You could pay someone to be a professional skeptic about whether, spousal abuse is actually, good for the nuclear family. And that's kind of the situation we're in now with climate change. The evidence is beyond overwhelming. Whether you want to believe science or the overwhelming consensus of scientists, just believe what you see with your own eyes and notice or what you read in the news with the undeniable prevalence now of droughts and floods. We're the food price spike in the States because there was an unprecedented drought through over about 2/3 of the United States this summer. And it's just true that it is literally like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic is what we're doing. There's an elephant in the room that's bigger than any other thing that you can think of. And which is not to say there aren't a lot of pressing issues in today's world, but we're talking about the destabilizing the ability of this planet to maintain any climate. We tend to look at climate change as though there's going to be a before and an after picture, that climate change will change this climate into some other climate, and that we'll adapt, and that we'll do what we have to do, and that it won't affect us very much because we've got air conditioning.
But, well, I've seen the Jetsons, so I'm pretty sure that it would involve bubble-topped hover cars.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But there is no after picture to climate change. We're talking about destabilizing climate, period, and preventing this planet from having the ability to have a stable climate. And we're flirting with the very real reality of a runaway climate change, which could just simply render this planet uninhabitable. And all we have to do is look at Venus to see a planet that it has undergone a runaway greenhouse effect. Mm-hmm. It has surface temperatures of about 500 degrees Celsius, which is beyond what you can't have water in liquid form at those temperatures. So there's no liquid water on Venus, which is, as far as we know, essential to all life. All life on Earth doesn't need oxygen. Not all life on Earth needs sunlight. Not all life on Earth needs the same things, but all life on Earth has one thing in common, and that's liquid water. And a runaway greenhouse effect could seriously turn all the water on this planet into vapor, and you would have a dead planet. We have clearly identified the mechanisms by which the greenhouse effect could become self-sustaining and runaway. One of my favorites that I like to point out is that there's literally gigatons of methane stored in the permafrost in the tundras of the Earth, around the planet. And methane is about 20 times more potent as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And as the planet warms, the permafrost, the tundra, is thawing and releasing this essentially fossil methane into the atmosphere. And we're talking about just gigatons, like unimaginable amounts of methane, that is going to cause more warming, which will cause more thawing, which will cause, more release of methane in a self-sustaining cycle. And once all that's out, what regulatory process is left on Earth to sequester carbon at a rate that will bring the climate back into any kind of balance? You'll just have a runaway greenhouse effect.
Mm. We've actually got, due to some training that's going on here at CIUT, I've actually got more techs in my studio than I do hosts today. So I'm going to put one or two of them on the spot here for a moment. The idea here is just, we're talking about, whether or not mainstream media covers the news. I know that Ryan and I immerse ourselves, bathe daily in environmental news. We're all tapped into all sorts of resources. You guys maybe aren't. I know Ryan, for instance, Ryan Knight's in the studio there, recent father, professional business owner, very busy guy all around. I know that you don't have time to go out of your way and look for environment news, so maybe you're a better gauge than I. How often do you, in just your day-to-day, when you're in the, Tim Hortons picking up your coffee in the morning or whatever, do you ever see environment coverage? Do you ever see the word climate change in a newspaper if you're not going out of your way looking for it? I don't know if, Michael, if you want to jump in on that as well.
Well, yeah. The thing that everybody has to understand is we just had Superstorm Sandy. If people still have a thought that climate change is a myth, this storm was 1,000 miles big over like the United States, and for stuff to happen and people to realize it has to happen to the United States of America.
No,
they dropped
17
million gallons of water on New York City. So the real focus is going to be on climate change now, because these types of superstorms, like Superstorm, was just not
And that was a warm-up, too. I mean, it was compared to Katrina, it was far less intense. So the thing that was outstanding about Sandy was that it was a larger storm, but it was less intense than Katrina. If we had something the size of Sandy with the intensity of Katrina, half the U.S., the eastern seaboard would have been wiped off the map.
Exactly. And so, these types of superstorms, it's an actual phrase that our society is built to withstand a superstorm every 100 years. And now we're getting these superstorms every 25 years. So if another one of these hits within 25 years, our infrastructure is almost going to collapse. And then if another one hits within another 25 years, it might just wipe us off like the biblical times Noah floating around. You know what I mean? So
I thought we were going to stay away from religion. This, I'm just teasing. Go ahead. I mean, that's definitely, you know, that's definitely intensity is.
So you're going to see climate change in the newspapers a lot more.
But have you? And I'm gonna get Michael to chime in really quickly as well here. But just do you see in your day to day? I mean, I don't think that you're someone who on a regular basis goes out of your way to find environment stories. Do you ever see stuff in your day-to-day about the environment? Like, am I, because I know, as I was saying, Kevin and I sort of like, we sort of bathe in environment news daily. In your day-to-day, is this article right? Does the mainstream media ignore environment news and climate change news? Or do you see these stories?
I think it is becoming increasingly common to see stories about the environment, certainly in the day-to-day. But I'll be the first to admit that I live a pretty privileged existence in my first world apartment in my mega city in Canada. So from this privileged perspective, I can say, yes, absolutely, climate change is very important to me. I read stories and news about it on a pretty regular basis. But depending on one's circumstances and one's lifestyle and one's interests, education, so many factors, it could be that climate change is still under the radar of the majority of people. Certainly, I mean, when we look at the coverage of Sandy and we see the devastation to New York, and so much is omitted about the devastation to Cuba and Haiti and countries that are less developed than ours, I think that in itself is indicative of both the challenges we face and also the impact of these stories and these issues. People in Haiti probably aren't so concerned with global warming and their participation in those activities that could contribute to it, because they're more interested in feeding themselves.
Yeah, truth be told. Fair point. Nope. Very fair point. Absolutely. And I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it on that note. That's all the time we have for today. Thank you very much to Ryan Knight and Michael McDougall for letting me put them on the spot today a little bit. They were not forewarned. I just felt like jumping them in there. Kevin's been a great, great fun today by agreeing to basically be my co-host today. It was kind of fun.
Thanks,
fun for me. I think he enjoyed himself as well. As I said, we're experimenting a little bit with format right now. So if you have any comments, questions, or suggestions about the way that we're doing the show, you like something we did before, you like something we did today, we're going to keep doing this throughout the week. And of course, we're still live on the Twitter feed during the shows as well. I did forget to mention that, but every single week we are live responding to Twitter's feeds as well. So if you have a comment or question live during the program, you can go to our Twitter feed at Green Majority. Don't forget to check out the website as well, greenmajority.ca. However, that is all the time we have for today. I want to thank all my guests. Again, you can go and check out, and we're going to have links to the stories that we discussed today, which was the ocean fertilization experiments, Resource Minister Joe Oliver not knowing very much about energy projects, and the Trans-Canada Chinese-owned Phoenix Energy Partner-Up pipeline story. All those stories will be available on the website, so go to greenmajority.ca. Thanks again to our community partners in CIUT. Until next week, have a great weekend. We'll talk to you then. See ya.